Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Ourselves or with others across time and culture, stories have been the agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls are to share stories from the lives of incredible change makers from around the world. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Today, we have an incredible guest speaker whose passion for the stars and space exploration ended up leading him down a path back to Earth and within. His name is Rikin Gandhi. While Rikin's organization, Digital Green, uses an innovative digital platform for community engagement to improve the lives of rural communities and specifically farmers across South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, there's a deeper sense of purpose and meaning for him and those that he works with and aims to serve. Rikin recently shared that at Digital Green, we start with a sense of gratitude, and we have the opportunity to stand with the poor. We see the world not just as it is, but as it could be. We elevate others' voices to imagine a better future for ourselves, as they are sources of inspiration that lead to innovation. And we know the challenge is not easy, and that investing in the growth of one another is as important as those whom we serve. As you can easily surmise, Rikin and his team is nothing short of inspiring, and we're very grateful that he is here with us today. And staying on that note of gratitude, behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. And so we're thankful to them and all of you as our listeners for helping co-create today's space. So let's start, as we do each week, with a minute of silence to really anchor ourselves and truly bring our full attention and presence to the call. So a minute of silence. Thank you. So again, welcome to our weekly Awaken call. Here's how today's call will work. In a few minutes, I'm going to turn things over to our moderator, Rish Sanghvi, who will briefly share some thoughts with us, provide a more formal introduction of our featured guest, Rikin, and we'll engage in a deep dialogue with him. Then around the top of the hour, we're going to roll into a Q&A and a circle of sharing. And this is part of the call where we invite reflections and questions from all of our listeners. Now, I've actually gone ahead and already opened up the Q&A right now, but so that at any point during the call, you can enter the queue if you want to eventually ask your question. And you can join the queue by hitting *6 on your phone. And then when it's that time, we'll be prompted it'll be your turn to speak. You could also email us during the call at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And we're happy to ask your question or share your comment as well. So our theme for this week is, you know, shifting our gaze from the stars to the earth and within. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, at one point, Rikin had aspired and prepared to be an astronaut in his life. But as after spending most of his life gazing outward and beyond the physical limits of the earth, he turned it inward and back toward earth and realized he wanted a better way to connect to this world and its people. And so we've been asking people this week, you know, have you had situations where you've gazed outward to the external world for meaning, only to find that that true meaning and satisfaction require looking inward? And how has that inward gaze allowed you to better connect with others? When we had one of our frequent listeners write in, David, who had said, "I've looked outward for meaning, such as to look for outward for approval, and have learned that true meaning really comes from looking inward, such as the realizing that meaning that is most important to me comes from me, and to look inward is to see whether or not I have my approval. Inward gaze has helped me realize that we are much more alike than different, which has helped me better connect with others." And so, Rish, I was hoping with that you could continue the circle, share some of your own thoughts, and then please introduce us to Rick in and we can dive right into the conversation.
Yes, thank you very much, Amit. So the idea of the answers being much closer to home is something I'm certainly attuned to, you know, not just because I often look for my keys while they're still in my pocket, but this thing that even the listener shared about shortening the distance to our answers and sort of looking farther out, it is something that we've all been close to at some point or another. What I'm intrigued by in the case of Rickon is that rarely is that contrast so stark. You know, this is someone who literally is an MIT-trained rocket scientist, and at some point decided that it would be better for him to run a nonprofit working on agricultural practices, digging deep into the earth, quite literally. And what they do at Digital Green is to produce and share video content of farming best practices with each other. But of course, the work goes much deeper than that. Rickon himself, he's an Ashoka Fellow. He has won many accolades. Beyond that, I know him personally, and just an amazing, grounded, and humble individual. And so I'd like to open up this call by welcoming Rickon and hearing from Rickon himself. Rickon, thank you for being on the call today.
Thank you so much, Trish. Great to be with you.
Great. Let's start with this aspiration of you wanting to be an astronaut. Almost every child wants to be an astronaut, but what our listeners may not know, Rickon, is the level of intensity and commitment that you had to this. This was obviously not a passing phase for you. Can you paint a picture of the level of your commitment to your childhood dream for our listeners?
Sure. So it was like at a very young age, around age like 5 or 6, that I saw the first footage of, you know, those 1960s era images of astronauts on the surface of the moon. And from that point on, I was clipping out newspaper articles that featured astronauts and would read biographies of them to try to put together my own astronaut playbook to try to get to space. I studied engineering, got a pilot license, and was about to enlist in the U.S. Air Force with this aspiration of being able to make it to space.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't think I've had a playbook on being an astronaut. So you were about to enlist, and then what happened?
Well, I went back to the same biographies that I was trying to follow while I was growing up. And what I had focused on growing up was largely what they did to get to space. And I was just trying to emulate the same for myself. But while I was in the waiting queue with the Air Force, as I was waiting for some medical clearance to kind of go through, I had a chance to look back at those very same biographies and look at what did these astronauts do after they came back to Earth. And what I saw is that a number of astronauts, they see the Earth from this new perspective from above, and they wonder, why is there war? Why is there poverty? And several astronauts come back to Earth and have become public school teachers or farmers to really reconnect with the world and its people. And although I never made that sort of, I never made it all the way to space myself, I sort of had that change of heart myself and changed trajectory.
Yeah, you didn't have to go all the way out there to get to the same, to reach the same conclusion. And when you, so now this is something you've been working on for since childhood. When you had the shift, did it feel very natural? What was your internal state? Was there a sense of loss or grieving, or did you immediately feel the sense of clarity and purpose? Because I think a lot of times transitions are very interesting moments, and I'd love to hear a little bit more from you on how you made that transition.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, growing up and having like that that very driven aspiration to try to become an astronaut, I have, I guess, some sort of proclivity to trying to be on mission. And earlier it was to try to get myself into space. And then as I had like sort of this reflection of what would it be for me to like say rare opportunity that everything works out and I did get to have my 15 minutes in space, what would I do afterwards? There certainly was like a lot of reflection and back and forth on what does this mean, and you know, perhaps I should just stay the course because at some level the astronaut playbook is perhaps more well defined. Although it's of course hard, it has certain steps that you need to take to be able to potentially, you know, get there. And so that was perhaps the most disconcerting for me, was to say that, well, if I'm going to, you know, really take this new mission of reconnecting with the world and its people, which is a very broad one and unclear of like what it entails, it obviously is going to be much more open-ended and is going to require a lot more, even just soul searching around where do I even, you know, begin. But that's where I just decided to kind of go out to India. That was about 10 years ago, and joined some friends from college who were starting up a biodiesel venture in Maharashtra. And there was nothing specific about that venture or that place, other than I thought that it aligned to like this new mission that I had in my heart, and that I wanted to try to make the first step towards better understanding it and myself in the process.
Great, thank you. So you're trying to create your own playbook for this new thing. And so tell us how that connects to the beginnings of Digital Green. Biodiesel venture, quite far from, you know, helping farmers do videos. How did one thing lead to the next?
Yeah, so while we were just trying to get this biodiesel venture started off in Maharashtra, one of the things that I quickly saw was the fact that there's a small minority of farmers who are seeing agriculture as a source of prosperity for themselves, for their families, being able to send their kids to school, earning a good living. And then there's the majority of farmers in those very same villages where those prosperous farmers reside, who see it as a vocation of last resort, that they are hit by the vagaries of like climate or markets, that they don't know what to do or where to begin. And so they're in a point of desperation and have lost a lot of self-confidence in themselves, and often are looking to move out of these rural communities as quickly as they can to try to see if they could find a better life elsewhere. And that's where I then connected with Microsoft Research in Bangalore in India. And we had this opportunity to think about, is there a way that perhaps technology might be able to bridge this sort of chasm between these more prosperous farmers who are very hopeful and the majority of small-scale farmers who aren't? And is there a way perhaps just like, you know, for myself, like on reflection on even my own journey of wanting to try to, you know, get to the stars and go to space, and looking at those grainy sort of images of Apollo era astronauts on the surface of the moon, could those same tools perhaps be ways that we could think about shifting people's aspirations and own confidence in themselves towards saying that this agricultural practice that they have doesn't have to be this desperate situation.
Interesting idea of trying to relate back what might be applicable to space back to the farmers. And I want to come back to that because I think you have some thoughts on that. Can you tell us a little bit about, so once you start engaging with the agricultural community and your early experiences, what were some of the stories and the experiences that you had there that were particularly moving or compelling for you?
Well, I think as we started like the work for me personally, like we started with using like video as a tool perhaps to be able to capture some of these stories of other farmers in these like local communities to be able to share their stories with their peers more effectively. And to be able to kind of create new role models in the communities. And some of the things that we've actually seen over the years has been things like There was once like a woman who was ostracized from like her village, and not just sort of psychologically ostracized, but even physically, where she was pushed out to the edge of like the village community. We were able to record some of her stories of applying some practices in agriculture that were more sustainable, that boosted up like her economic status, even as just a single mother. And we shared that with her peer group of farmers in her own village. And what transpired was that they invited her back into like the core community to not just like watch her video, but to have her speak to them and share and ask and be able to ask questions of her. So that was really exciting to be able to see some of these like bonds kind of like come together in these communities. And it's also exciting to see how these folks who often like we work with a majority of the communities that we work with are women, and oftentimes, you know, their own like voices are low, like from a even just an audible volume point of view. And we've seen like just by featuring some of these women's voices who perhaps like start off as being like desperate, where they're, you know, we've had like a woman in Madhya Pradesh that we were working with who talked about how she's lost faith in even God because of her circumstances of not being able to make ends meet in her home because she wasn't getting enough wheat to even be able to feed her family for the whole 12 months of the year. And as a result of applying some of these practices, and then more than that, even being able to be featured in some of these videos, you can even hear her voice become like loud, and she has now become like almost a village leader in her community as a result of having gone through this journey.
So you're undoubtedly seeing real transformations, and these stories speak to that. I think when you aggregate all of that, I was reading that Digital Green has reached, you know, there's a million such stories now. There's a million farmers that have been reached. You guys are posting impressive metrics. 10 times cheaper to facilitate best practices, 7 times more likely that a farmer will try a new method after looking at one of the videos. You know, one of the reasons you mentioned you're so successful in this approach where others have tried as well, when we were speaking earlier this week, like, and you talked about demonstrating a sensitivity to basic human psychology, that if you notice that if a farmer in the video had a watch on their wrist, then if a farmer who was watching that video couldn't afford a watch, they would be less likely to adopt their practices. Similarly, having women in the videos, like you mentioned, has been incredibly effective. Can you share with us more of your thoughts and experiences around this and this idea of, you know, what are some basic underlying human elements that have come out of the projects that you've seen, even within yourself or within the community?
Yeah, what we've seen is just how much human identification with your peers really is what ultimately affects people's own aspirations to try to think that the information that they might be exposed to is of relevance for them and that they might try. You know, oftentimes, like these videos, when you go and look at like these 5,000 videos that we now have, they have names like this is a composting video or this is a video on how to improve your rice productivity. However, more than like the technicalities of the step-by-step information about how you do a particular practice, what people are really looking for is the stories of these individuals and how they can be able to relate with them. Just like that example of that widow farmer that I mentioned, we've also in Ethiopia worked with a research organization called IFPRI, where they ran like this trial where they compared two types of videos. One was where they were just kind of producing videos around pure demonstrative types of information that went through the technicalities of a particular practice versus a video that really featured an individual sharing his or her story and then having other members of their local community, from the local village leader to other peers, affirming that this was, you know, a great farmer. And they showed these two types of videos in a randomized control trial. And after 6 months, they measured the people's aspirations about looking at the psychology of even the levels of people's like desperation towards and feeling about perhaps helpless against like say God or the government or optimism to saying that no, I can actually do this myself. I can actually improve my level and status in life. And they found that those second types of videos, the ones that were more aspirational in nature, were the ones that ultimately really changed them. And if I look at my own self, like that's what happened to me too, in terms of even having that first mission of like wanting to go to space. I certainly like went through the biographies to look at the technicalities of how to get there. But at another level, that whole like mission orientation to say that there's something like beyond myself, there's this larger cosmos that, you know, I think human curiosity just drives us to like better understand. Is what drove me to want to like be an astronaut. And in the same way, that's what is sort of happening for like these rural communities, as their aspirations about themselves is starting to shift as they see these peers in their communities, and not just like seeing them, but also having discussion with one another as these videos are being shared, because those peer effects that happen through the videos and kind of in real life with one another as they're after the video shows talking with each other is ultimately what drives the change.
So you notice the universal drive for aspiration. What other, anything else in terms of insights or things that you've gleaned over these last 10 years on, I would say, the basic human condition, if, you know, not to put too philosophical a point on it, but yeah.
I think that the other one is that drives our work is this notion of homophily, like the psychological concept, which is how do you, the social distance between two individuals is ultimately what drives people's like connection with them. And so like in these video screenings, if you attended one of them in one of the villages where we work, the questions that you're going to hear first aren't about the economics or the return on investment of the practices, but rather what's the name of the person in the video and which village is he or she from. People are really trying to connect with the people that they are seeing and seeing if they can identify with them for themselves. And I think we see that not just kind of in these rural communities, but if you look at the way of the internet and, you know, the type of fragmentation that we see of perhaps, you know, people on one spectrum of the ideological sort of spectrum going to this particular like news sources or the other side kind of living in their own bubble. That sort of condition of all of us kind of having an inherent sense of like tribalism and relating to like people who we think are similar to ourselves is also true across, you know, across demographics, across conditions. I think there's opportunities to break through it by featuring other people into the mix. But to the extent that you can show sort of a cross-section of people that really relates with the cross-section of people that is going to be accessing that piece of information, that's when you're going to really see people to take it up, to believe it, and to perhaps change as a result.
Thank you. What has been the impact of Digital Green? Now, you talked about a lot of the external impact that Digital Green is having on these communities. What has been the impact of Digital Green on you personally? What are the shifts that it has enabled for you?
Yeah, I think for me, it's really been a journey of learning. You know, when we started this work, I had no aspiration of setting up an organization or trying to even create a development impact. For me, it was just to see if there was a way that I could spend my time on a mission that I thought was underserved and that perhaps, you know, I could learn something more about and maybe in the process sort of contribute. But at each stage in our journey at Digital Green, from being a research project at Microsoft to having the opportunity to spin it off to now, you know, working across both the developing and even the developed worlds, because we've recently started also working not just in South Asia and Africa, but also in the U.S., is to be able to learn about how I can learn better about the kinds of change that's possible, even within myself, even before I think about the type of change that might be possible in the rest of the world. And I think that's what's different between like what I was hoping to try to achieve by the astronaut path, where it was that well laid out path for me to be able to just kind of do one step at a time. Whereas in this new kind of stream of activity that I'm in with Digital Green, it's much more of a process of change that it requires of me, and that I feel like that I'm growing through myself even before I think about the work that we're doing in the world.
When you talked about Digital Green, you said that we start with a sense of gratitude. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah, I think the opportunity that we have to work with these rural communities at this kind of like level, right? We're working with 1 million people now across South Asia and Africa. And these folks have so much inherent potential. And I think for us as an organization and for me as an individual, to even be able to like think about what could be useful, what could be a catalytic for them to be able to unleash that potential so that they aren't in that place of desperation, so that they grow their self-confidence, so that they can sort of be able to take like their next sort of growth in themselves and for them and for their families. There's a real humility that I think that requires to even think that you could be that or serve that function. And I think we at Digital Green are learning so much from these communities and from the partners that we work with in the process about what are even our own interests, and what is also our kind of like true purpose as a result of engaging these communities. That's what we're most grateful for.
How do you operationalize that, Rickon? Like, is that more a philosophical underpinning of Digital Green, or do you have practices that you actually incorporate into your daily operations? Like, is there something you do? Because I think a lot of organizations are trying to be in this space, but how do you operationalize something like that?
Well, one is like to you know, distill it like in the form of even like language, a common like framework of being able to talk about it with one another. And also applying the very same sort of like practices that we or approaches that we use in the world within ourselves. So, for instance, like we use videos at the community level to be able to share practices of agriculture amongst farmers. But we also now have like videos about team members sharing information about some of these cultural values about lifting each other's voices. Or you know, standing with the poor with a sense of gratitude, to be able to within our own organization be able to hear and see through video how other team members are living that out in the work that they do, whether they might even be not in the field, but maybe they're in a back office function in administration or finance, to be able to allow them to also share their own voices that might be translatable to peers in their kind of peer group.
Great. Yeah, that's it's very interesting how, you know, to move that beyond the philosophy. So thank you for sharing those thoughts. I wanted to ask you, now having done this for 10 years, having made the transition, been obviously very successful, what are you finding yourself occupied with lately? What matters to you lately? Where do you find the next frontier of growth for Digital Green, but more importantly, also for yourself?
So I think it's in two streams. One is for us to imbibe some of these like cultural elements that I just described more deeply at a team, and even for me at an individual level. And the second is to see how we can create even a deeper impact in these communities' lives, so that it isn't just that they're getting exposed to practices and that they may or may not apply these things for themselves. We've seen sort of these aspirational shifts, but I think there's more that we need to do to proactively enable that. And some of that requires us to go deeper than like information alone. For instance, we're also now starting to connect farmers physically to markets and such to be able to enable them to translate that information into tangible actions that they can see gains from, and that sort of reinforces them to be able to participate sort of in this sort of larger knowledge exchange, so to speak. And I think for us at an organizational level, you know, we've largely taken this approach of using videos and using them to share information amongst farmer to farmer. But we now are seeing like that there might be different situations in different sort of geographies where we're expanding, where perhaps like the entry point of sharing those stories might have to vary, right? It may not always just have to be done over video. Maybe you can use other forms of media, or perhaps there are other channels to be able to provide support.
And what about for yourself personally? What's the next frontier for you for growth?
For me, I think as we've been sort of growing this work, I've been trying to focus a lot more on how do we build the culture of an organization and the larger community of partners and rural communities that we work with to really imbibe like this spirit of lifting each other's voices, having each other's back, you know, seeing the least amongst us as the sources of inspiration for the work that we do or for the knowledge that we share. And I think especially as we've been growing, there can be like sort of a tendency to just kind of like focus on scale and expansion, but trying to see how can we make sure that we're not losing this ethos, not just like in like the day-to-day, but also the types of approaches that we take, the types of policies that we create, the systems that we develop. And I find myself, I guess, pushing my own self to make sure that we're embodying that spirit.
Yeah, and that's hard to do. I think especially given your success, it just that's great. I want to come back to something you mentioned early on, and I promised I would come back to it, because I'm curious about what similarities you found between rocket science and the work that you do at Digital Green. You alluded to this earlier, that you were challenging yourself to say, okay, what are some things that I know that I can apply to this unknown area that there isn't a playbook for, right? So what did you find?
Yeah, It's one that you have to approach these partners in these communities with a position of humility and really to understand what is it that they do and what is it that you can learn from them and perhaps see what you can contribute. And I think one of the major learnings that we've had or that I've had personally as a result of like looking at the parallel of like my own inspiration of trying to pursue sort of the dream of going to space and this new mission is just the power that stories and media can have towards affecting that. And you know, of course, our work at the community level does this as I've described by featuring like local individuals that people are able to relate with. More recently, we've also, for instance, co-produced like a reality TV show to try to change the discourse of agriculture in India has such a negative connotation that is largely based on the major, you know, tragedy, which is a farmer suicide, and it's a real problem that needs to be addressed. But you can only imagine for if you're a farmer who is exposed to media that just is talking about documentaries related to farmer suicides, it further reduces your own confidence in yourself and feeling about, you know, your own self-worth. If all, you know, you hear is peers or others like you who are committing suicide. And so what we wanted to try to do is to have at least an additional voice in that mainstream sort of media discourse about agriculture by producing a reality TV show, which was like a 13-episode series, where we'd have young kind of contestants applying practice like drip irrigation or preparing a meal with local millets, and doing it kind of in an entertainment and sort of educational kind of like format that people were able to relate with. And almost the primary audience of this program was largely urban audiences, because rural audiences are often the ones who are looking to urban communities as their source of aspiration. And so what we found is that that by changing some of like how urban India, for instance, looks at rural India, who this benefits the most is rural India, because they start to think that, oh, urban folks like in Bombay care about compost making or some of the things that we do. That makes me feel like what I'm doing has some like more worth to it. And so, yeah, and I think like this is very much related to like how I was also looking at like these astronauts on those images. And also kind of gaining my own inspiration.
So it kind of reminds me of this, the point you made earlier about aspirational, that if you can, that it's the aspirational quality that gets the most traction, even in the videos. And it's like you almost have people see themselves in a different light, in a better light, and it's empowering. How did the reality TV 13-episode series go? How was it received, and what changes have you seen in have you discerned any real impact from that?
So yeah, it's hard, like, because broadcast television is a harder thing to measure. But you know, the program got about 2 million views across 4 like major networks in India. But what we see is like kind of more like these intangibles. That are more anecdotal, I suppose, in nature, where the farming communities communities themselves, you know, relate like that, like looking at some of these programs, that hey, this person is like, you know, preparing a meal with like local millets, and we didn't even know like local millets are being consumed in urban India. We always thought that they just are eating like, you know, staples like white rice and wheat, but to see them doing a cook-off with ragi, for instance, a figure millet in South India, showed to like some of these ragi growing farmers that that what they're doing also has relevance and has interest and value amongst these folks that they all always just thought, you know, are into like going towards like white rice and other types of commodities, which are things that they often see in other types of media programs like Bollywood films or other types of television programs. And for them to see this kind of, and they were able to notice like even this, it's a small element like of this kind of like reality TV show that probably some audiences wouldn't even like pick out. But for a rural audience, like who kind of receives like the trickle down effect, they're able to relate it with it because that's like their bread and butter is like these millets that they're both producing and consuming, and to see that these folks that they aspire at some level to become doing these things and being excited about them sort of confers even greater excitement and confidence for themselves.
Yeah, so I'm hearing that these intangibles are often seems like they're as important, if not more. Not just for the reality TV story, but even for Digital Green, I saw this. Any thoughts on kind of the tension between this need for showing tangible impact versus the real value of intangibles, and how you're processing that and managing that tension? Because it seems like some of these intangibles are equally valuable, but obviously you can't demonstrate it in a way you can only talk about it. You can only tell stories about them. And it comes back to this point of the value of stories, right?
That's right. Yeah, and so I mean, our primary proxy is looking at like whether people apply the practices that they see or hear about like for themselves on their farms and physically observing like did they do so or not. But for us, I would say that that's kind of a means to an end, right? That it's a, this technicality of a particular practice is a stepping stone, hopefully, for these communities to be able to gain the intangible of greater sense of self, right? And that's what we're trying to shift, even for ourselves as an organization and the work that we do.
Oh, interesting. And what would you say? Okay, so what would you say are the intangibles that you, as members of the organization, are receiving, right? That you or people are working for you. Yeah.
Well, it's this change in perception and this greater sense of like curiosity at some level and wonderment. I mean, I think related to even us. My journey towards space and these aspirations of what these astronauts conferred, it's what is like the cosmos? It's this expansive thing that we can never like wrap our minds around. And also, if we look at like at the human condition, it's also something that we can like never be able to really wrap our minds around. And what I think this journey is enabling for myself and for our team, especially as we are kind of getting a greater sense of seeing like these concrete types of actions that we can take as more of like that means to an end of the intangible is that greater sense of like ourselves in the process of who are we and what is our human condition and how like it and it creates shows us as a team what these inherent tensions are between like ourselves and like the rest of the external world. And we might be doing something concrete in the external world. Like we might be like working with these like rural communities, but we're also growing at the same time. And that might be at some level almost like our purpose, or even as an organization is our team's own growth, which is why that's also part of our cultural manifesto.
That's beautiful. Goes back to this idea of the inner transformation, or the you know the answers, the engagement being closer to home than you thought, right? That's really great. Where do you see this work? And by this work, I mean the external work, the internal work, all of it taking you over the next few years as you look out to, you know, the next 5-10 years.
That's a good question. I think what we're moving towards as an organization is to try to reduce the divides between our work and the external work, like with like rural communities versus us, or with us and our partners, or between the developing and the developed kinds of worlds. Each of these sorts of variables at some level seem silos of their own. And what we hope to be able to at least be one part of a catalyst in is to see if we can sort of bridge some of these divides. And, you know, I mentioned like how there is just this inherent human psychology of living in your tribe. And sometimes, you know, living in your tribe can be very beneficial. But there is also utility in kind of bringing together some of these more disparate groups, even for us as an organization. And that's like a new role that we've never found ourselves in. We've just been pretty like heads down in terms of like working with these rural communities, training them to produce and show videos and that kind of thing. And certainly I think that's the concrete action that can now allow us in these next kind of like 5 years or so to think about how can we use that to bring more of these communities, these disparate siloed ones together. And I think we've only begun that journey. Like the reality TV show is just, you know, one of those kind of darts that were thrown. But there's certainly a lot more that needs to be. And, you know, for instance, like the work that we're doing even in the U.S. also is, you know, does it have to be seen that small-scale farmers, you know, have to be totally disconnected, and everyone like sort of looks down upon them from like the rest of like the agricultural scene. There's already been a lot of like studies that have shown that that it's that efficiency of agriculture is not sort of an economies of scale type of game, right? Like that these small farmers also have like their own like learnings and knowledge and perspectives that are perhaps even valuable for the larger types of developed world types of communities, as is vice versa.
And on one hand, there's that. So actually, several questions came out of that. There's also this element of the knowledge. So actually, let me backtrack just a little bit. Bridging divides. Would that be a good personal slogan for you, for your life's work, and for the work of Digital Green? Does that encapsulate what you think?
Perhaps. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if there was a divide, but. Yeah, I don't know if I like the term divide as much, but yeah, in terms of like trying to bring folks together and leveraging, you know, technology and process to facilitate that way, that in a way that people find mutually beneficial.
And then this coming back to this idea of, you know, the rural farmers having something to share with the world, and as against that, this idea of local knowledge being really important and being relevant versus, you know, being globally applicable. Do you see a paradox there?
There could be, but I think like, so if I look at our current work with the videos, the approach is not like, a totally like user generated content type of play, like one would expect. Think of with a service like, say, YouTube, where anyone can produce anything about anything to anyone, right? Ours is a little bit more like a Wikipedia type of model, where anyone can still like kind of contribute, but there is like this community of like people who are practitioners or researchers, might be more global or might be more local in nature, who are also able to kind of like moderate and help curate some of this information for wider sharing. So that we don't end up just with like a huge fragmented sort of like world.
I see. Well, that's an important distinction. But thank you for clarifying that. Okay, Rick, and I have a question on the lighter side. So you just became a father, Amara, your daughter is 6 months old. What impact has that had on you, your work, and your outlook being a father of 6 months?
Well, yeah, she's amazing. And I think, you know, for the last 10 years, Digital Green has been like my baby of sorts. And now we actually have a real one. And I think what's amazing with her, seeing her in these last 6 months, like, you know, develop and grow so quickly is, you know, just to be able to see her own sort of like wonderment and curiosity. And just inherent potential in like it wrapped up in her small 6 month body, and you know, I think for me it's like seeing like development firsthand in our own household, and it just speaks about like the human condition, which is just there is like so much potential in everyone. And it's just about, you know, nurturing it or kindling it or perhaps reigniting it. That sometimes needs to take place, and that's how I relate it to like the work that we do in general at Digital Green with the experience that I've had with Amar over these 6 months.
Thank you for sharing that. So I'm going to pause. That's been really, thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts and insights. Very interesting. I'm going to jump back in, see if we have questions from listeners at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of you that are on the call, have a question for Rickon, please push *6 and you'll be entered into our queue. You may ask him a question, or you can always, again, email us at ask@servicespace.org. You know,
okay, great. And while they're getting those questions lined up, just wanted to ask you, I heard you say that you're now, I mean, you started in India, Rickon. I noticed that you now got projects in Ethiopia or other parts of Africa. Now you're in the U.S. even. And, you know, some view would say, oh, do the farmers in the U.S. really need the kind of help that, or, you know, do they need the kind of service that the folks in India and Africa do? What would you say? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, the percentage of farmers in America is of course, small. It's, you know, less than 2% of the population is involved in agriculture. But of those of that population, about 80% of that population is small scale farmers, and there are a large number of immigrants and refugee kinds of communities who are involved in agriculture in the U.S. and in a lot of ways are faced very similar challenges to those abroad from not being able to be able to grow the commodities that they might be more aware of. Like we work with, for instance, like in California with Hmong and Mien types of communities who mostly are involved in like growing Asian vegetables. And there's not a great system to be able to support them, whether from the government or other nonprofits. They're often like leasing very expensive land and they're kicked off that leased land every year. So they're not able to invest in like really developing like their farms for the long term, whether that be like investing in irrigation or other types or soil sort of fertility management types of practices instead of just kind of rotating around. And they also face like ultimately those same issues of self-confidence and self-worth that we see everywhere. Agriculture is just one of these very difficult vocations that involves just a myriad of a number of variables from markets to government schemes to climate, many of which are out of one's hands. And you operate at a pretty razor thin margin. And for us, especially like a small farmer who has limited ability to kind of hedge those risks, they can find themselves on the wrong side of things pretty often. And so, we've actually found, like, even some of our videos, like, that were produced, like, in India are relevant for, like, these farmers here in the U.S. And what a great stroke of, like, confidence boost that gives to, like, Indian farmers to know, like, that their videos are being, like, watched by, like, some farmer in America.
That's amazing. It goes to speaking about one of the intangible values and also just the universality amidst what seems to be these local differences. So thank you for sharing that.
You know, Rick, and I wanted to just sort of jump in here for a second. This is Amit, and ask, you know, if you could just sort of walk us a little bit through the process when you first got started, because I think it is really interesting when you think about putting together these videos, and now that you guys are almost, you know, 4,500 to 5,000 videos in, you know, there's definitely an easy process and you guys know what works and what doesn't work. But I think it's always interesting that learning curve that you have in the beginning, or even having people have the courage to be able to come onto video, in particular, maybe even some of the women in India, to share, you know, have that confidence to share, and then, you know, feeling that it's important enough or it's of value. And so if you could walk us through some of those lessons learned, that'd be really interesting.
Sure. Yeah, glad to. You know, for us, it starts by partnering with local organizations who already work with these rural communities. So these are organizations like the Ministry of Rural Development in India or various NGOs, in various places who already are working with these rural communities, have already mobilized them into, say, women's self-help groups or farmer clubs, and already have frontline village-level workers who engage them and train them on improved practices and whatnot. We then kind of come in and we train folks at the district level, usually 4 to 5 people from this local partner organization in the communities that they work with, to produce these short videos that are 8 to 10 minutes in length. And then share these videos, which aren't scripted. They're just sort of roughly storyboarded out to try to get the testimonials and demonstrations of practices from real farmer experience. And then these videos are then distributed primarily offline by these village workers of our partner organizations who already are from these same communities and are already engaging them. to then facilitate the screening of these videos amongst those very same women's self-help groups and farmer clubs that they were working with. And basically layering on top of this existing program that, you know, we've partnered with is what allows us to be able to reach the level of trust and the level of scale that we've been able to do so. With regard to the question about, you know, people's interest in, like, appearing in these videos or even producing these videos, especially women, we've been really impressed to see how much innate interest and curiosity there is in people. And at some level, being featured in a video is seen as a status symbol in these communities. And we've never had a problem of, like, people raising up their hands to want to be featured in, you know, whatever the next video is going to be about.
No, that's great. And I guess earlier too, you were talking about how, you know, these videos just, it's not someone sitting there with their, you know, kind of turning on a selfie camera or anything of that nature. These are all very carefully curated. And so, you know, you have a team of what, about 60, 65 people that work with Digital Green. And I'm curious, what does that makeup look like? You know, I mean, you said that there's a psychology component to thing. There's obviously research component. There's outreach at the grassroots level. And so I'm just curious how you put together this incredible team that's been able to be expansive just, you know, in India as well as sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, it's a pretty eclectic kind of group. We're now about 100 people. And
oh, wow.
Basically, like, there's a couple of key sort of, like, subgroups within our team. One is the one that works with our partners, which is basically like a trainer of trainers to operationalize, you know, this whole process of producing videos and showing videos and collecting data and feedback from these local communities and just standing that whole activity up, and doing it in a way that we're not the ones who actually do, like, the day-to-day activities of producing any video or showing any video or collecting any video. We're just enablers of, like, getting that system operationalized with these local communities and the partners that were already, like, working with each other previous to us even entering into the picture. And then we also have, like, a software engineering team that does some of the work around building out some of the systems for collecting data and sharing videos in places that have, like, limited connectivity and electricity. We've got a team that's involved in research and learning to continue to push ourselves to understand what is the type of change that, whether it is qualitative and intangible in nature or more quantitative impact, and seeing how we can improve ourselves. And then of course there's the back office functions as well. So I'd say these are the primary sorts of folks involved, but we've been able to achieve, like, the scale that we have with this relatively smallish group, largely because of the great partners that we work with and their existing trust and relationships that they have with the communities that they work with.
Hmm. So, you know, are you finding that the work that you're doing, even though it's primarily related to agricultural practices, is it having a halo effect on addressing or equalizing some of the social ills that you might see in these villages, whether it's, you know, just certain mindsets? Like, say, for example, you know, social hierarchies and class hierarchies and things like that. Is it equalizing things or having an effect in those ways as well? Even though I realize that's not your primary purpose.
Yeah, I think so. The one element that we've looked at more closely is how, from a social dimension of how this work is having an effect, is women's inclusion in especially, like, decision making at the household level. Mm-hmm. So the primary audience for, like, these video screenings in India is, like, women's self-help groups who are involved in microcredit and savings kinds of activities, and now, these individuals in these groups become the primary source of new information that they're getting exposed to for their whole household. And so what it does is it sort of, like, changes even, like, that dynamic in the household where, you know, the husband isn't watching the video, but he's often asking his wife now about like, hey, what did you go for this meeting for, and what did you learn? And for a woman who perhaps always was involved in the agricultural labor side of like things, now she has a voice in actually thinking about like, what should we do on our farm and what, how should we manage it better? So that's happened there. And in some of our work in Ethiopia, we're also, what we found was that, that there was this hierarchy even amongst like farmers who would have like greater access, to information, that they would have these so-called like model farmers who the government would be primarily working with to the neglect of like the rest of like the majority of farmers who are perhaps not model farmers. But through this exercise, we found like that by featuring videos that feature non-model farmers and also women, we're able to connect with these other more marginalized types of communities, and as a result, they themselves then gain a greater standing within their respective communities. Actually, going back to that IFPRI study that I mentioned, where they were looking at the differences between a demonstrative kind of like video and a more testimonial or a kind of video which was more aspirational in nature. What they also found in that aspirational video case was not just that like people ended up adopting more agricultural practices, even though those aspirational videos didn't actually contain any specific information on agriculture information, but they also ended up sending their kids more to school. They ended up having like more savings kind of in their accounts. These like changing people's aspirations or notions of themselves, yeah, ends up having a much larger effect that goes well beyond whatever technicality of an information that you might want them to apply.
And this is just a quick reminder to our callers that if you do have a question for Rickon, please push *6, so you can email us at ask@servicespace.org. We had one of our listeners write in, his name is Charles, and he writes, might the gaze be beyond the inward and the outward in the physical world? How might we connect with which we cannot see, describe, or understand? Rickon, in creating Digital Green, were you not just sharing better ways of working through your video technology, but perhaps might you have also been sharing hope in a growing sense of community?
Yeah, I think so. That's our aspiration. I think we're not necessarily fully there. There's, you know, perhaps some intangibles that we've been able to record in our work till date that sort of reflect some of those changes in aspirations and hope that has been conferred by our work. I would say that although, you know, our work is typified by the fact that we're producing and sharing videos, that really represents kind of like 20% of like the work that we do and the type of outcome that we want to like achieve, right? Like 80% of what we want to achieve is more of like this kind of like intangible change. And really these are just like tools that are being used as a means to an end, because you do need some means to have some concreteness of what is it that you're doing and how do people connect with it. But it's definitely not like the end game.
There, you know, the same individual also asks or comments, you know, Rickon, it's been such wonderful sharing. Have you connected your desire to reach space to perhaps not to get this desire to venture into the quest of understanding life and death? Has the two birds in a tree metaphor ever been helpful in your work? And this might be helpful in connection with the fragmentation that you might see all over the place. Again, great effort, Charles, from Germany.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that Nachiketa's story, the Hindu myth about a person who was single-focused in trying to find in transcending material desires for liberation and whatnot. And I guess this idea being that has your quest, whether it's in rocket science or with Digital Green, been in some ways an effort to transcend. And then I think just a shout out to say thank you from Charles again.
Cool. No, thank you so much. And I would say that, yeah, for me, it was at that juncture between making the switch from pursuing sort of that to try to pursue the astronaut dream versus, you know, seeking out sort of a new mission. There are lots of questions around purpose and also, yeah, life and death types of questions related to, like, the fact of, like, what would I do if I went to space and what would happen afterwards? And so there was certainly, like, a spiritual seeking kind of, like, dimension to also, you know, what happened as I was thinking about, like, how can I go beyond just thinking about myself to, like, have these, like, 15 minutes of space in a very, like, physical kind of, like, experience sort of way, and perhaps try to have be able to change myself from a more deeper kind of even spiritual sort of dimension, even though it was an unclear one and one that, you know, I'd say that I'm still kind of, like, seeking and learning. That was certainly part of the transition that took place. And some of that is also reflective of some of the astronauts who have seen, like, the Earth from above and gained, like, that sense of wanting to transcend, because you really see and experience, like, the enormity of it all. And reading these biographies of these astronauts sort of made me sort of, like, live it through.
Hello? I think we lost you there.
Hello, Rick?
Hello? Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes, okay, great.
So, okay, I think we lost the last piece of that, but if you wouldn't mind just repeating that last piece.
Oh, I was just connecting, like, sort of my own journey that happened, like, between, like, pursuing, like, the space sort of, like, mission to searching for, like, this new mission, and it having, like, this kind of spiritual element, and also relating it back to many astronauts, you know, in their biographies talk about how they've had, like, these epiphanies, you know, looking at the enormity of space and Earth, like, kind of in its perspective. And of course, you know, I didn't go all the way, but like, looking through, like, some of these biographies, I sort of experienced, I guess, some of it for myself.
Mm. Well, which biographies have you read that you would recommend? Sorry, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, there's lots. but I guess, like, the ones that I especially would recommend, there was one book that I especially liked, which was for Rick Husband. He was an astronaut who kind of, like, flew in the space shuttle missions, and he actually died kind of in the Columbia sort of, like, disaster. But he wrote a book called High Calling, where he talks about sort of, like, that kind of epiphany that he had while in space, and how it sort of changed the course of his life afterwards in terms of similarly trying to, like, not obviously going to go into, like, rural India, but kind of getting back to the roots of people and trying to understand from, like, within, what does it mean to be here on Earth.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That's great. I'm going to go to one of our callers who's in the queue.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm Kathy. And my question has to do with, you've been talking about aspiration and studying how the videos have inspired and motivated people. And I'm curious what you might have learned about resilience and perseverance when the sort of vagaries of life bruise our aspirations. What kinds of things are helping people in those, grappling with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, like, what we find in our work is, you know, one could think that, yeah, like, these videos, they're all aspirational in nature. So you want to, like, avoid the situation. It's like that they're creating, like, false hope, right? Like, in like, real circumstances where, you know, things go awry, as they certainly do and can. The way that we sort of address that is by featuring real people's stories where they talk about the issues that they face, and also sometimes like how those circumstances don't always lead to like positive outcomes. So we actually have a mix. So there's content which, says like, this is what you should do, and this is the person whose story it is that did it, and you could be like him too. But there's also stories that talk about like how perhaps somebody did kind of like face like a challenge, and then and maybe it was because of an issue that was not even like of their own volition. We sort of share some of those kind of like stories to kind of like show like that these are real stories of people to be able to relate with. And there's sometimes learnings that can be had even in those circumstances that perhaps like things did go awry, but perhaps like that person had like applied some practices that like kind of helped them at least like not lose everything or like lose faith in themselves. And so that is also a story that also kind of like connects with people, to say that, you know, it's not all just, you know, like that everyone is like boosted their incomes like by 10x. No, there's also certain stories that also are show like even how conditions didn't go as planned and what did people do about it. And I think that's also boosts like people's like confidence in themselves to say that, you know, actually I can control at least some parts of like my destiny, and that can serve as a way to boost people's agency in the process.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate the question. Rick, and I just want to go back to, you know, what you were saying earlier. You were sharing about some of the books that you read, the autobiographies this past week. We talk about space exploration, the loss of John Glenn, very much a hero and titan in his own sense. And I know that there's, you know, when you think about, you know, your world now, when you think about some of the farmers and stories you heard, is there a hero that sort of comes to mind, sort of an unsung hero, someone that, you know, the world may not have heard of, but you through your work have heard of and has found inspirational?
Yeah, I think so. One of the women that we have that I was able to kind of like meet directly kind of like in the field, and kind of build some amount of relationship with was this woman Suganbai in Madhya Pradesh, and she was that farmer that I was actually referring to earlier on the call, who had like that desperate circumstance of having given up on God and on even like her family to because she was just not able to like feed her family. And for the whole year, because they just weren't buying enough produce. Her husband had migrated out, but she was pushing. She was able to kind of come out of that circumstance by seeing like peers that seemed to be doing better, and that somehow pulled themselves out of that circumstance. And she was able to get some, I think, some sheep initially to be able to take care of, and then to produce some extra milk that helped to kind of hold things over when some of their kind of staple crops weren't doing as well. And she ended up appearing in a number of Digital Green videos featuring like dairy production to even some staple crop production types of videos, to eventually even, you know, one thing that we did in Bombay once was to have a film festival of some of the farmers that we work with and their videos presenting to urban gardener kinds of associations in Bombay. And she was able to share like that story of like how she got out of like her circumstance, how she's now become like a role model and is in these videos to be able to share her own like learnings with others. to now like this urban audience, and this urban audience just like looked at her and was so impressed with like the level of confidence that she displayed, and the fact like that they had like things to learn from him, from her on even how they might kind of like do their own compost pits in on their, you know, terraces in Bombay. So that's the kind of like farmer hero that I think, you know, we see everywhere across like rural India. And it's not just like those prosperous farmers, you know, that I mentioned. Those are the prosperous farmers who, you know, really have made it. But, you know, even those farmers who've kind of like given up at some level sometimes, they're actually, you know, it's pretty remarkable to see like that they are actually pretty resilient, like heroes too. And they just sometimes don't even know it for themselves. And sometimes it's just being able to like feature them in a story or on a video that can be the confidence boost for them to realize it.
That's great. I think, you know, well, a good part of our audience, you know, tends to be involved with social work or social entrepreneurship. And I think, you know, a question that sort of would come from that community is, it's not easy doing the work that you're doing, and I'm sure there have been moments in Digital Greens history where you wondered if this thing was really going to work or it was really going to be successful. And so I was wondering if you could share a moment or two of that and how you were able to sort of push through. And obviously you guys are doing very well now, over 100 people and well established. But, you know, the journey there is not as easy as it's often maybe painted as.
Yeah, I think there's been points along the journey. I would say, like, perhaps my most personal one was, like, when we were first starting, like, Digital Green as a part of Microsoft Research. And we had no plan. It was an open-ended research question about is there a role for technology in small-scale agriculture. I went out with a video camera, of which I'm not super capable and nor an avid fan of, but I was just gonna try to like produce like some videos with these rural communities and try to, you know, see if they would be interested in watching them. And, you know, in those early days I would just be kind of like walking through villages to see like if people would be open to like being featured in these videos. Of course, I wasn't doing it totally alone. There was an NGO called Green Foundation that I was partnered with, but it was still a struggle to get like people to, you know, initially understand like why would you want a video. They were fine like to be featured in a video, but mm-hmm. like they were like, why would you want to do this like on our farm about like some, you know, composting type of practice that we just do all the time. And initially there were times when people would even think like that perhaps like I was a spy or was like, you know, why was I coming like as like this foreign entity trying to record them like do like their own like day-to-day work. So that was certainly like those challenging days where it was like really unclear where like this, you know, may or may not lead. And then I think the other bit was initially we were a research project, and so a lot of like the onus of the work was pushed by us as researchers to kind of like try like this new approach with this NGO and with these like local communities. And that was useful. We did get like, you know, research results out of it. However, on the other side of things, the challenge was that it didn't like breed much ownership within our partner organizations or the communities, because it was always us as the researchers who wanted to try out something and not them who really saw it as something that would enable them to be able to, you know, improve themselves. But we had to make a shift actually at that point, which is essentially when we spun off from Microsoft. And we basically presented that this is kind of like the sort of approach that we've seen to be successful till date in these, you know, specific communities that we've rolled it out. But if you're interested, you know, you should sort of let us know if this it might be relevant for the work that you do. And that really like changed the game, because then the onus was on these partners in the communities And that's really what I'd say has accelerated sort of the growth that we've had over these years.
That's great. You know, obviously, when you start to take a look at the numbers, both obviously your organization's growth, but the analytics and the efficacy of these videos in these farming and rural communities, I'm sure the question has come up in terms of, well, you know, if these videos are so helpful and so effective, well, what other sort of social issues can we use this type of platform to have an impact on, you know, like such as women's health issues or, you know, perhaps alcoholism in certain rural or even urban slum areas? And so I'm curious, has Digital Green explored that? Is that something that might be a part of the horizon over the next 5-7 years?
Yeah, well, so, you know, one of the sources of inspiration for our work was a program called Digital Study Hall, which used video for primary school education, where they would record private school teachers teaching after school to slum school kids and share those videos on science, math, and English types of lessons with surrounding government school teachers to improve the pedagogy in their classrooms. And that was found to be successful. And actually, that was the reason why we even started with this interest in thinking about like the use of video in the agricultural space. So, at Digital Green, we've actually expanded our work such that it's actually not just focused on agriculture. There's also information related to nutrition and women's health and other types of messages too. The main driver ultimately of like what messages are, you know, promoted or not promoted through our channel is a combination of the partners that we work with and the communities that they engage. Because like the information in and of itself depends on a lot of other complementary product services, markets, resources that are going to be needed, right? Even if it is like, say, like a tomato practice, people are going to have questions about where do I get the seed or where do I get the credit for the seed or where's the market to sell my tomatoes? Or if it's like a iron folic acid tablet type of video, right? Like in the health scheme of things, again, people are going to have questions of where is it available? Where's these IFA tablets available? How much do they cost? And what if I have problems when I consume it? And so that's why these partners that we work with are so key. And actually, like our very name, Digital Green, comes from that. Like Green Foundation was our very first partner NGO that we worked with. And we mm-hmm. were just adding on like the digital component to it. That's how we became Digital Green.
Well, that's great. That's wonderful. You know, as a community, you know, one of the things that we like to always ask our guests are, you know, what can we do to further support you and the work that you're doing?
Well, I would say that one is, you know, if folks know of organizations or individuals, you know, that might be complementary to the sort of work that we're doing, we're always kind of like on the lookout for potential like collaborators on the ground in the various geographies where we work. And the other bit I would say is that, you know, encourage everyone to plant their own seed of creating their own sort of dream of the kind of change that they can create, and maybe, you know, that change might not be like an external one, but it might be more of an internal one. But through like the means of doing something on the ground, you might find yourself changing in the process.
You know, Rick, and I really appreciate it on behalf of all the callers. Your time today, Rish, thank you very much for a wonderful, masterful job of moderating this conversation. I think there's so much to sort of, you know, we're going to take a look back just over the course of the last hour and a half in terms of hearing your story, how things sort of evolved, and just that real power of, you know, not, you know, even after you go after your dreams and maybe something sort of comes in the way, knowing that there's a deeper sense of purpose. And that's, That's one of the things I'm really looking going to take away, and I'm grateful for today's call. So really appreciate you spending your time with us today, even though you're in the midst of travels. I think one of the things that we like to do is always end our call with a quick moment of gratitude in silence, just out of appreciation for what's been shared and really for a space like this to hear such wonderful stories. And so I'm going to call for a quick moment of silence, after which I'm going to take everyone off of mute. And if we can give a big, giant collective thank you to Rickon, it would be a nice way to sort of end the call. So a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And here on the count of three, if we could do a big collective thank you from everyone, that'd be great. Two and three.
Thank you, Rickon.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.